Cold mornings, frosty windows. Yep, it's that time of year. So treat yourself and start your day with a cup of fresh roasted Sterling Roastery coffee, sourced from around the world and roasted multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. It's the kind of warm-up every sports fan deserves this holiday season. And right now, you can win one of three $50 Sterling gift cards, perfect for gifting or building your own winning lineup of Java in the morning. Enter today at sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways so you can wake up, warm up, and Sterling up this holiday season. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
125 defining moments, one legendary league. This is Darren Hayes of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, and a great book is out right now, NFL Moments, 125 Icons and Stories That Define the NFL. It's a definitive visual history of the National Football League, packed with iconic images and untold stories behind the game's biggest plays and its greatest players. From the early legends like Red Grange to today's stars like Patrick Mahomes, this book is a touchdown for fans who crave more than just stories. So give your football bookshelf a Hall of Fame upgrade or snag a holiday gift for that NFL history buff on your shopping list. Pick up NFL Moments, available now at your favorite bookseller.
This is former NFL offensive tackle George Kunz, and you're listening to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
Welcome to the official Football Learning Academy podcast. I'm your host, Ken Crippen, and I'm the founder and lead instructor at the Football Learning Academy, an online school teaching pro football history. To learn more about the Football Learning Academy, go to our website at www.football-learning-academy.com. Not only will you find links to our social media channels and a listing of all podcast episodes, but you'll find other fascinating interviews and classes. And an important note, a portion of all proceeds generated at the Football Learning Academy go to help retired players in need. That website again is www.football-learning-academy.com. Today's special guest is former NFL offensive lineman Lomas Brown, who was selected by the Detroit Lions in the first round of the 1985 NFL Draft. He played 11 seasons for the Detroit Lions, then played for the Arizona Cardinals, Cleveland Browns, New York Giants, and won a Super Bowl with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. This seven-time Pro Bowler has been inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame, the University of Florida Hall of Fame, the Detroit Lions Hall of Fame, and is on the Detroit Lions all-time team. Now let's get to our interview with Lomas Brown. I'd like to welcome Lomas Brown to the official Football Learning Academy podcast. How are you doing today, big fella?
Doing pretty good. A little tired. The big fella's a little tired, but doing pretty good, Ken.
All right. Let's start with the current Lions. I know you just got back from covering the game last night. So what are your thoughts on last night's game with the Chiefs?
Yeah, I mean, disappointing result from the game. You know, it's been tough on us because of a lot of the injuries we have, especially in our secondary. And when you go up against a guy like Patrick Mahomes, you need to be at full strength, especially in the secondary. And just kind of disappointed by the way the game ended with the scrum that happened or the fight, whatever you want to call it, that happened with our player, Brian Branch. Really just kind of disappointed about that. And, you know, and it just shouldn't have happened. You know, great competitive game. And for the end that way, it just kind of left a sour taste in our mouth. So hopefully we could get healthy, get some of our guys back, and try to get back at full strength because we got a big game coming up with Tampa on Monday night.
Yeah, talk about that. What do you think you need to do in order to be able to play well against them and get things back on track?
Yeah, the first thing is try to get as healthy as we can. I mean, if you think about it, it's been tough on especially Calvin Shepard, our defensive coordinator, with losing some of the guys we've lost. I mean, we pretty much have lost all our secondary. You just don't know if a suspension is going to come around for Brian Branch, Kirby Joseph, our other safety. He was kind of hobbling most of the game. So we could really, really be shorthanded when we face this Tampa Bay team. And Baker Mayfield has been playing. I mean, besides Jared Goff, I think Baker Mayfield has been playing at a high MVP level. They're going to be ready. We've beaten them the last couple of years, so I know they want a little revenge coming into this game. So, and there's a lot riding on this game, especially in the NFC, how the NFC is shaping up. So this is going to be a huge game for us. And after coming off a loss, you like to try to win the game, the next game that you play. So it'd be important for us to kind of be at full strength and to really put our best foot forward.
I mean, what are your thoughts overall on the Lions season so far?
It's been great. I mean, it really has been. You looked at the season before it started, and you might have seen a few more losses than what we had there. But I think the guys have done very well. We're sitting at, I think we're 5-2 now, if I'm not mistaken, 4-2. Well, you know, but again, at this point of the season, you didn't count on having the injuries that we have right now. Like I say, especially since we went through that last year. But I'm proud the way this team is shaping up. A lot of people thought because we lost Ben Johnson and lost Aaron Glenn that would kind of take the team down. But I think this team might be a little better than the team we had last year. You know, a lot of that is yet to be seen, and we still got a long way to go in this season. But I like the adjustments we made, especially with our coaching staff. And I like these guys that are on our team.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned it last year. You were decimated by injuries. This year, especially, you know, you had said it before, your secondary is decimated by injuries, but yet you're still finding that way to win. I mean, that to me speaks to the character of the team. But then, you know, and that all comes from Dan Campbell.
That's right. You're exactly right. As long as we have him, I think we have the recipe to have them winning teams, to bring in, as they say, him and Brad Holmes, the right type of guys. It's just not anybody that can play for the Detroit Lions. And that hadn't always been the case. But they seem to bring in the right guy, and the next guy up mentality that really does exist here. And they expect the next guy to be able to step in there and kind of keep that level of play at the same level.
Now let's dig back into some of your history. And so I understand it was your high school principal that convinced you to play football. Tell me about that and how that transpired.
Yeah, his name was Alex Bromier. And basically I was in the band 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. Pretty good too, Ken. I was pretty good with the trombone playing band. But my first day of high school, I went in and signed up for classes. When I came out the auditorium, somebody was like, "Hey," turned around, did not know it was the principal. He called me over to him and he asked me, did I sign up for varsity sports? And I was like, no. So he grabbed me by the arm and took me back in the auditorium and he signed me up for varsity sports. And I had to wait till the last period of the day to find out that varsity sports was football. So I was never the type of kid that liked to disappoint people. So I went out there, even though I didn't want to. I went out there. And as they say, the rest was history. And, you know, Alex Bromier has since passed. But every time I would go back to the high school, I would thank him for what he did. Because if he wouldn't have never signed me up for varsity sports, I know I wouldn't be sitting here today talking to you about football. So he just really kind of changed the path of my life. And I always thought him for that when he was alive.
Were you a big fella back then, or?
I was my first year in high school. I was probably about 6'3", and I was probably like 190 pounds. And I guess he seen something in me I really didn't see in myself, you know. And and it was just great. So he, like I said, it's just great. And the lesson that I always try to tell kids about that is, you never know where your opportunity is going to come. You never know how your opportunity is going to look, but always try to keep an open mind to it. And, you know, I was just happy that I did keep an open mind to going out there and trying to play football, because, like I say, I would have never met some of the people or some of the doors that have been open for me in my life. I've never gotten that opportunity.
Now, at 6'3", 190, were you playing O-line or were you playing a different position?
No, you know, kids, they don't volunteer to play offensive line. You get kind of chosen to play offensive line. But my first 2 years, I was at defensive end. It wasn't until my senior year when my head coach, the late, great Buddy Goins, started having me play both ways. And then, of course, when I went on some of the recruiting trips, I kind of heard that offensive line chatter. And when I really got to the University of Florida under Charlie Pell, that's when he told me I was going to be a full-time lineman, no more defense. And, you know, I think it was the best thing. I know it was the best thing that happened to me, me concentrating and being on that side of the line rather than the defensive side of the line. But, you know, any big kid that we think we could play every other position but the offensive line.
Now, you're a Miami guy, and you went to the University of Florida. Why did you go there instead of the University of Miami?
Yeah, a good question. You know, to be honest with you, I started running with the wrong group of guys. I really did, and I knew I needed to get out of Miami. I tell people, if you look at my scholarship to this day, it's only one signature on that scholarship. My mom signed it. My dad, he wanted me to go to UM. I mean, Coach Snellenberger had my dad hook, line, and sinker. And you couldn't tell my dad it was another school in America but the University of Miami. And when I decided to go to the University of Florida, he just refused to sign the scholarship. And, you know, I think my dad, you know, he grew up in the South and kind of in that area. You know, it was a little racial in that area. And he kind of knew from growing up in that area in Tallahassee and all around there. And I think he was thinking about it more so from that point, more so than me playing ball there. You know, his son going to that part of the Florida and how it was when he grew up. But again, I started running with the wrong group of guys down there in Miami, and that's easy to do as a young guy. And like I say, I knew I had to get out of there, kind of put a barrier between myself and my friends, and that 5-hour drive from Miami to Gainesville was enough.
Were other schools interested in you outside of those two?
Oh, yeah. I took an official visit to Ohio State. I went to Oklahoma. I went to Pittsburgh. I took one of my official visits to U of M, of course, the University of Florida. So, yeah, I had a lot of other schools interested in me. But back then, you could only take, I think, 5-6 recruiting visits. So I took all 6 of my visits and, like I say, ended up in Gainesville.
Now, prior to the NFL draft, how many teams showed interest in you?
So, funny story about that. I really didn't know a lot about that process. Where it was my junior year at Florida when an agent came there, and he kind of told me that I was, back then in my junior year, I was like the 83rd ranked player in my junior year. So that meant, I guess that meant like around the third, fourth round, I could get drafted. And that's when, that was like the first time I kind of knew where I was ranked at amongst the college players. So what that did was give me the opportunity to go back and work hard my senior year and try to better my position in the draft. And that's just what I did. And it all worked out. The Lions ended up drafting me number 6 in the draft. So I didn't know. I mean, nowadays, you know, the guys got so much technology and so much at their disposal to, they know stuff like that. But back in our days in the, you know, mid 80s, it wasn't readily available. So, like I say, until this agent came to campus and kind of let not just me, but a couple of my other teammates kind of know where they were, it just gave me a goal to work for. And I just tried to work for it my senior year.
All right. You get that call on draft day that you're going to be a Detroit Lion. Talk to me about that day and how it felt being drafted by the Lions.
Yeah, it was It was different because the Lions never worked me. They never contacted me. They never worked me out. I never heard Detroit and any of the teams from my agent, who's Peter Johnson with IMG. He never brought the Lions up. It was either Cleveland. I heard Philadelphia. I even heard Green Bay, San Fran. I heard all these other teams, but the Lions never heard the Lions once. Until Daryl Rogers called me two picks before they were picking. And he said if Chris Dolman gets picked and Dwayne Bickett get picked by Minnesota and by Indianapolis, we're going to take you. And that's what happened. Those two players got took by those teams, and the Lions called me. And they said, you're a Detroit Lion. And I remember being on the phone with Daryl Rogers, and it was like this awkward silence. And then he was like, aren't you happy? And I was like, oh, yeah, I am happy. But I think I was more shocked that Detroit called me and chose me. And, you know, it was the three things I knew about Detroit back then from Miami is, one, it was cold. Two, they made cars, but three, back in 1985, it was the murder capital of the U.S. So I'm like, those were the only three things I knew about Detroit. But I'm telling you, man, it was the best thing that happened to me. It really was. It was unexpected, but it was the best thing. My first 11 years were there. First 4 years were really tough. And then, you know, we got that little fella, number 20, and things turned around for us in Detroit. So it was great. This is home for me now. My family's here. And I love the state of Michigan.
Well, we'll talk about the little fella here in a second. But talk to me about the learning curve going from the college to the NFL.
Man, it's unbelievable, man. It really is. And don't forget, I played in the SEC, which I consider the best conference in football. And to me, if you play in the SEC, I think that's the conference that gets you more ready to step into the NFL. But when you step into the NFL, and I don't care who you are, I seen Barry struggle a little bit when he first got there. It's going to be a learning curve, and it's just how fast you could get through that learning curve. And, you know, the first thing you know this, and you know when you get in the NFL, it's everybody's fast. Everybody. I just remember we used to run wind sprints, and you would see Eddie Murray, the kicker, running past us. And it's a kicker, man. I mean, but everybody in the NFL is fast. And then the other thing you learn about the NFL is that it is a business. It's a business. You got grown men out there who have families they have to support, and they take it serious. So if you're not ready, man, you're not, like they say, the NFL is not for long. You won't be in the NFL for long if you aren't ready. So that was the biggest thing to me, the speed of the game, just how much faster it was than college. And like I say, you got these grown men who, this is a business now. It's not for fun. You know, it's a true, true business that you just stepped into.
All right, let's talk about the little fella. So as you mentioned, you know, some of the years that you were in Detroit, you were blocking for one of the greatest players of all time in Barry Sanders. So one, that's got to be a dream for an offensive lineman. And tell me how that made you a better offensive lineman by playing with a guy like that.
Yeah, it was. And don't forget, Ken, I almost had two number 20s. I missed Billy Sims by 1 year because he tore his knee up in 1984, and they drafted me in 1985. So I would have got the block for two of the greatest number 20s, at least in our franchise history. But, you know, like you said, once we got Barry, we weren't thought of from 85 to 89 or 88, however you want to call it. We were an afterthought. We didn't get any national games, never been on Monday night TV. None of that came our way. And once we drafted Barry in 1989, it was like all eyes on us because of Barry Sanders. People wanted to watch him. And so that brought in all the national broadcasts. And, you know, we were able to get some of those primetime games. And, you know, people say, I tell you what's true. You know, you always hear the analogy, you have to block till you hear the whistle. It was never so more true than with Barry Sanders, because B, he could have a play that takes him that way and you turn around and he's behind you way over here. You just kind of never know where he was going to be. So myself, Kevin Glover, we used to always say we're going to block to the whistle, because you never wanted to be that guy that let your guy come off and tackle Barry. So it was true. You had to block to the whistle till you heard the whistle, because you never knew where he was going to be. And the other thing about Barry, man, was, you know, everybody could pull up YouTube and see some of his great plays, that great runs that he made. But me and Kevin Glover, every Monday in film study after a game on that Monday, it would always be 5 to 6 plays. And it may be a 2 yard, it may be a 2 yard gain, or it may be a 2 yard loss, but it's going to be the most awesome 2 yard gain, a 2 yard loss that you've ever seen in your life. And the dude would always make you say, man, how did he do that with that clicker? You just sitting there just seeing how he was able to do some of the things that he was able to do. So just a great player, and I think even a better person. That's why you wanted to block for him and made sure he had success, because just as great of a player as he was on the field, he was probably a greater person off the field.
Now, you had been in the league for a few years by the time that he came in. So talk to me about how you mentored him early in his career.
Yeah, just trying to just wrap my arms around him. Again, like I say, it's a learning curve when you get in the NFL, and you don't need to lean on somebody. I don't care who you are. You could talk to any Hall of Famer that's in the hall. They're going to tell you that when they first got in the league. The great Lawrence Taylor, all of them will tell you that it is a learning curve. And if you got a vet there that can kind of show you the ropes and kind of help shorten that learning curve, it's just only going to make you better. And that's what we tried to do with Barry. We just tried to make sure that we kind of showed him what we've been through. So, some of those things, those pitfalls, he didn't have to go through, but just kind of take care of him. He's a guy from Oklahoma, Kansas, in that area, coming to Detroit, the big city, you know. So it's an adjustment. It's not only an adjustment on the field, but it's an adjustment off the field. And that's what I tell guys. You know, when you say you're a professional, you have to be the complete player. It's not only about what you do on the field, but it's about what you do off the field and how you carry yourself and what type of person you want to be known as, your character, your reputation. So it's a lot of things going into being a successful NFL, NBA, MLB, whatever, National Hockey League player. It's a lot that goes into that, and it's just not only on the playing field.
Imagine that Oklahoma backfield, Barry Sanders and Thurman Thomas at the same time.
I know. But just think about the coach. What trips me out the most is that Barry played defensive back in high school. Mm-hmm. That just blows my mind that the coach let all that talent in high school. I don't know. He might have played a little bit, in high school running back, but he was primarily on the defensive side of the ball. So that trips me out, too, when I always hear that about Barry. Mm-hmm.
Now, you went through a couple of teams after you left the Lions and ended with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers getting a Super Bowl ring, but you were a backup at the time. Was it kind of bittersweet to get the ring?
No, you know what? That's a great question, but I'll tell you this. One, I didn't sign with Tampa Bay till 2 days going to training camp. So I knew I was behind the eight ball. I was behind the eight ball the whole time trying to catch up and learn the system. And as you know, Coach Gruden was our coach, so we ran the West Coast offense, which is a tough offense to learn. But I'll say this, too, that Roman Oben, who started in front of me, he had a great year. He did. He had a great year that year. So I don't even know if I could have overtook him because of the year that he had that year. He deserved the start that year. And, you know, I started 17 out of my 18 years, and it was great. It was just great to win the Super Bowl. Of course, as you know, I lost the Super Bowl 2 years earlier with the Giants versus the Ravens. But, you know, that was a great team to be on, the Tampa Bay team. Great defensively, man. When you think about some of the Hall of Famers and Warren Sapp, Derek Brooks, Rondé Barber, John Lynch, hopefully soon to be Simeon Rice was on that team. We had a great defense, and, you know, offensively with Keyshawn Johnson and Mike Allstott, you know, leading that team, Brad Johnson was our quarterback. You know, we had some weapons on the offensive side of the ball, so it was just great getting the chance to play for Coach Gruden, and he took care of me. That's my guy. He took care of me, man. I have no complaints about my time in Tampa Bay. And the crazy part was I was older than Coach Gruden. So I kind of understood. I was a year older than him. So, you know, that tough love that he gave, maybe Keyshawn and some of them guys, they didn't appreciate it. But me being older than him, I kind of knew where he was coming from. And it was a magical time that year in 02 down in Tampa Bay.
Now, after your season with Tampa Bay, I knew there was some interest from the Steelers to get you to come back for another season, but you said no. What made you finally hang up the cleats?
Yeah, I mean, Kelvin Colbert, who was one of our top execs here when I was with the Lions, he called me, and I just remember I got a call, phone call from Coach Cowher. And, oh, my goodness, that man could sell ice to Eskimos. He was, I mean, he had me on the phone, and he had convinced me that I could come in and play. And he told me, he said, Lomas, we're going to get you in here. He said, you'll practice Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. We travel on Saturday. I think we were playing Philadelphia. And he said, I'm going to start you on Sunday. And I'm sitting back. And, Ken, I hadn't done much. I did what they call the fat boy workout that whole time. And that's everything laying down, you know, the bench press, leg press. It was only those exercises. So, you know, I knew I wasn't in the ultimate shape. And this was like the sixth game of the season. But Coach Cowher was such a salesman, man. I see why guys ran through walls for this guy. And he had me, yeah, Coach, you're right. I think I could do it. I could do it. I could do it. And we hung up the phone, and I remember waking up about 3 that morning, and I called my – because I had the flight. He had set the flight and everything, and I called my agent about 3 that morning, and I told him, man, call Pittsburgh and tell them I'm not coming. Because that was going to be a challenge if you think about it. Stepping in, I'm 39 years old, soon to be 40, stepping into this, and it was already the sixth game of the season. So no preseason, none of that I had, and I was going to step into a real NFL game. So I think I made the right decision, even though it would probably have been nice to have the Pittsburgh Steelers on my resume. But, you know, I just didn't think I would be ready, like I say, to step into a regular season game after about 3 days of practice and no pre-camp, no training camp, or any of that either.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now you're retired from football and you go into broadcasting. So how has your perspective changed on football now that you're behind the mic, and talk to me about the transition of going into broadcasting?
Yeah, so the one thing I always said once I got into it, especially this latter part with doing radio and covering the Lions, because like you say, from 04 to 2012, I was with ESPN. So, you know, you're covering everybody. You know, you're an NFL analyst, so your job is to break down things and talk about what you see that goes on throughout the NFL. when I was able to get the job doing radio for the Lions, the one thing that I always say, I was just going to try to be fair in my criticism of the guys. And the reason why I felt that way was because it's such a hard game, man. This is a hard game that we play. And I played it for 18 years, so I know firsthand how hard the game is. And, you know, like I say, if I needed to criticize a guy, I was going to make sure it was constructive criticism instead of just kind of throwing guys under the bus or saying things. Because, again, I knew how hard this game is and how hard it is to stay in this game and how hard it is to be successful in this game. So that was the one thing I'm saying that I was going to make sure that I did. And, you know, that's what I've been trying to do ever since I've been commentating or been an analyst, especially for the Lions. So it's a hard game. It's a hard way to make a living. It's a great living. It's a great living you make. Like I said earlier, it's going to open up so many doors. You're going to build so many friendships the rest of your life. And you're in a small fraternity, a very small fraternity of guys to be able to say that you played in the NFL.
And an even smaller fraternity is that you were inducted into the Pride of the Lions, the Hall of Fame for the Detroit Lions. Talk to me about how you found out about your induction.
Yeah, I guess everybody knew months ahead except for me, even my family, you know, they were in on it and everything, but it was just a great surprise. I'm calling the game up in the booth with the great Dan Miller, and, you know, we always, it's a preseason game, so Rod Wood, the president of the Lions, he always comes up during the preseason and, you know, kind of talks about the season, some of the changes that have happened around, you know, the Detroit Lions. And he was up there giving his spiel. And then towards the end, he was like, "Big fella, I got a surprise for you." He said, "I want you to look at this screen, the big jumbo screen inside Ford Field." And they had put together a tribute video, and I had no idea it was coming. And it was awesome. It was shocking. It was humbling that they did that. And it was nice. It really was a nice twist. And I really, really appreciate the Lions for thinking enough of me to put me up there, because like you say, Ken, there's only 21 names up there with Robert Porsche going in this year. And think about the rich history of the Detroit Lions, all the Hall of Famers that we've had here, all the guys that have come through this organization. And for me to be one of the 21 guys up there inside Ford Field up on the wall, it's just a great honor. And the thing about it is that it's up there forever. You know, so when I'm not here, you know, my name will still be up there. And I think that's the most humbling thing.
Now, you've been inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame, the University of Florida Hall of Fame. And now you hear that the Lions are pushing for you to be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. How you feel about that?
Yeah, it's, again, another humbling act from this organization. Been nominated for a lot of years, and, you know, for the Lions to really get behind me and just the push that they've made, it's just been unbelievable how my phone has been blowing up, how many interviews I've been doing, and just some of the things that were said about me from some of my contemporaries, guys that I played against, guys that I played with. You know, just for them to say some of the things that they've said about me, you know, it's just been awesome. And I have to thank Greg Maiola from the Lions, because he really, really spearheaded this. It's something that he's been working on for months, and I didn't even know that, you know, and stuff till recently, how hard he had been working on all the different people he had talked to and everything. So, you know, it's just great that when you have an organization that believes in you and they're behind you trying to push you like that. Again, I keep using the word humble. I'm humbled by it, but I really am. And like I say, even if I don't get in, it's just been awesome to have my name with some of the greats that have ever played this game. I mean, the list of nominees is just player, great player after great player. And as you know, it's only, I think, Ken, maybe a little over 300 guys in that Hall of Fame family. You know, so you talking about a real, and over 20,000 guys that played in the NFL. So you talking about a small group, a really minute group of guys. You know, it's the best of the best. So it's just been great to be nominated with some of those guys, to be considered to go into the Hall of Fame with those guys. And hopefully it can happen. I've always been the type of person not to, you know, if things happen to me, it happens for a reason, and it happens at its own due time. So that's how I'm looking at it. But it's great to be mentioned with those guys.
Now let's shift a little bit. You spent a lot of time doing charitable work. Talk to me about some of the organizations that were most meaningful to you. And then also I want you to focus on the Lomas Brown Jr. Foundation, what you're doing with that foundation.
Yeah, so when I first got in the league, the one thing I said I wanted to do was, because, you know, offensive linemen, you know, people don't know who you are unless you do something wrong, you know, get a penalty, then they call you out. But most of the time, like I say, we're the faceless five until you really need an offensive lineman. So the one thing when I got in the league, I said I wanted to make my mark off the field too. And that's what I did when I first got in, by aligning myself with a lot of charities. I was with Big Brothers Big Sisters. I did the Boys and Girls Club, did a lot of charitable clubs around town. And then in 1991, I decided to start my foundation, the Lomas Brown Jr. Foundation. And my foundation is geared towards kids. And as you can see, me working with Big Brothers, Big Sisters, the Boys and Girls Club, that was something that was near and dear to me. So I focused my foundation in on kids. And as you know, if you help the kid, you indirectly help the family too. So what we do today, I started in 1991, and now we've progressed to the point where we do camps. I do sports camps, one-day sport camps and clinics, community camps and clinics. And then I have my educational camp, which is called the LEAP Camp, which stands for Learn, Earn, and Play. With my sports camps, I have probably about 5 to 6 contact hours with the kids, because it's basically a one-day camp. And the reason why I do that camp is not to create athletes or anything, but to show the kids, because as you know, the majority of those kids are going to end up right back in that community. So I'm trying to show them a way of being a positive in the community by doing camps for the youth, reaching out to the youth instead of being a negative in that community. Now, my LEAP camp that's my camp. That's my baby there. That's the one where I have a minimum of 60 contact hours with the kids. So you see, you have a lot more time with the kids. And basically, it's an educational camp where we have drones, we have 3D printing and imaging, we have media broadcast and boot camp, we have empowerment. We do a lot to expose the kids to different industries. Because as you know, if you expose these kids to this, they're like sponges. If it's something that they're interested in, they're going to soak it up and they're going to learn it. So you just have to give these kids an opportunity. And by having the LEAP camp, like I say, we cover so many industries that these kids get an opportunity to see different industries that they may be involved in. We have a nutritional part with that. And the reason why that camp is, that camp costs me about $70,000 to put on one of those camps. And the reason why is because, again, we have laptops, we have drones, we have the 3D printing imaging equipment that we use. But at the end of the camp, the kids, they don't know this before the camp starts, but at the end of the camp, if they successfully go through it, we let them keep all that equipment. So each and every year, I have to replenish that equipment. That's why that camp costs me so much to do. And the last thing about my foundation is it's all free to the kids. We never want to put a financial burden on the kids or their family. So the financial burden falls on my foundation. The generous corporate sponsors that I have or donors that I get, that's what enables me to keep these camps going and keep providing it for the kids here in Southeast Michigan.
So how can people find out more about your foundation?
So if they go to Lomas Brown Jr. Foundation.org, I know that's a lot, but if you go to Lomas Brown Jr. Foundation.org, you'll find out about the camps, up and coming events. I started I took over a golf outing. I don't even golf, but I took over for the great Paul W. Smith. I took his golf outing over last year. Was our first year. Our golf outing, the second annual, will be July the 13th, 2026, coming up. We have buttons where if you wanted to donate, you could donate to the foundation. You'll see all the events we did in the past, along with a lot of events that are coming up in the future.
Good. So since I know you like working with kids, what advice would you give a young offensive lineman hoping to make it into the NFL?
I think the thing about it, when you talk about young guys and you talk about young kids trying to go to the highest level, is shoot for it. I always tell my kids, I want you to dream big. Dream big. I mean, dream about the NFL, dream about going to the NBA, because if you dream big, to me, you're going to put in the work to try to get to that level. And say, even if you don't get to that level, you're going to set yourself up to have a successful life because of the work ethic that you put in to get there. You're going to meet so many great people, like I say, along the way that'll be willing to help you get to some of your goals. But if you fall short of getting in the professional league, I mean, guess what? That means to me, you're going to college. That means to me, you probably have a college education. And those are things that will set you up for success later on down in life, something that can never be taken away from you, that college education.
I'm going to put you on the spot here for a little bit. I'm going to make you a football scout. So talk to me about the skills necessary to play the left tackle position, namely, you know, what do you need to have and what are things you definitely do not want to see in a left tackle?
So the one thing you better have is a short memory. Okay, because I don't care who you are, you're going to get beat. Everything's not going to go your way. And what you don't want to do is stack bad plays upon bad plays. So in the NFL, I say that's a rule in general for anybody playing football or sports. You know, it's nothing you could do about that play that's happened. You have to move on to the next play, whether it was a good play or bad play. There's nothing you could do about that play anymore. So that's why I say have a short memory, move on to the next play. I think at the left tackle position, because you are going to face the best pass rushers on the opposing team, regardless of whether that guy's a household name or not, he's still the best pass rusher for that team. So you're going to have to be prepared each and every time you take the field, each and every play that you play a guy. So I say you have to be grounded in your technique. And the way to me, how you ground yourself in your technique, because it's only so much practice you can do. It's only so many hours in the day that you could be out there on the field practicing. That's where the mental reps come into play. That's what one of the things that I was big with was the thinking about my kick, thinking about where I'm going to put my hands, thinking about, you know, how I'm going to block this guy. You have to be able to put in the mental reps too, because like I say, it's only so much physically you could do each and every day. And mentally, you could put in a lot more time honing your craft. So those would be some of the things. It's a lot of other things that go into playing that position. But to me, those are some of the things that a young kid can do and work on. It's about the mental. People think football is all about the physical. Yeah, the physical has a big part to do with it, but the mental has so much more to do with the game because, again, you got to learn how to deal with success, but you got to learn how to deal with failure too. And like I say, the mental reps that you get, it's a lot of things. You know, when I talk to a lot of young kids, they are really shocked about how much time we spend in the classroom setting. You know, they think you're out on the football field all day long. No, that's only probably about 2, maybe 3 hours of your day. The rest of the day you spend over there is basically mental stuff that you are going over. You know, your plays, the playbook, you know, schemes, all those different things that requires your mental. So it's just as important for you to be mentally sharp and mentally all pro just as well as it is to be physically sharp and the physical all pro.
Now, who are the people that you watch play as you were developing as an offensive tackle? You know, what skills did you learn from them? What techniques did you learn from them? Who are your biggest influences?
Yeah, it was crazy because growing up, like I say, I didn't watch it. You know, I grew up in Miami, so the Miami Dolphins, man, that's my team. I am a Dolphin. And just the one person that I watched a little bit was the great Larry Little, who played for the Dolphins, even though that was a different position than what I played. He was him and Hog Hannah, because I just, you know, we used to play New England so much, the Dolphins did, you know, that name, you just heard John Madden and all those guys, Howard Cosell, mention his name so much, but that was about it. Once I got in the league, some of my mentors to me were the great Jackie Slater, watching him play. I look back at Gary Zimmerman, was a great Hall of Famer, was another great guy that I watched. Jimbo Covert from the Bears, he was another great guy that I watched. And one guy in particular was Chris Hinton. Used to watch his game and how he played. So it was a couple of guys I used to try to emulate, try to do some of the things that they did once I got into the league, because those guys were so successful and those were guys that you kind of wanted to be like. But I think probably out of that group, Jackie Slater was the one guy that gave me the most advice. And he told me, I remember at one Pro Bowl, he told me, he was like, Lomas, and I couldn't fathom this, but I think it was at my first Pro Bowl, which was in my sixth year. He told me, he's like, I want you to play 20 years in this league. Because he was approaching that. And the way he went about his business at that Pro Bowl practice, I was like, wow. That's when I really learned how you have to practice to stay on top of your game from watching Jackie Slater. And Jackie probably was in his 17th, 18th year back then. I couldn't quite get to 20. I got to 18. I couldn't quite get to 20 like he wanted me to, but he was a real mentor knowing that. And I don't even think he knew that. I don't think he knew that. And that's another thing that I kind of learned. You never know who's watching you. You never know who's watching you. That's why you have to always put your best foot forward.
All right, let's bring you back to current day again. So I was talking with a friend of mine who played, I think it was 7 years in the NFL, and he played left tackle as well. So we were talking about training camp. So a few questions kind of came out of that. What do you think of the overall quality of offensive line play? Do you think it's gone down? Do you think it's gone better because of the new rules in training camp with limited practices and pads, all that kind of stuff?
I don't think it's where it should be. And I wouldn't even just say it's that training camp. That has a lot to do with it, because I always say I don't see how these guys get ready for the regular season. Like you say, they go through no preseason. They rarely put on pads. I don't know how they condition their body, because I always felt that you had to condition your body not only to take hits, but deliver hits. And it's just strange to me how they don't do that nowadays. And you could kind of see, you know, the first game or two of the season is, you know, it's not at the level as it gets later in the season. And I think that's because training camp is missing. But I've been saying for a few years, guys don't practice their craft like they used to. They really don't as offensive linemen. You have to have, the first thing you have to have is be grounded, like I said earlier, in your fundamentals. I mean, you have to have your 45-degree pass set. You got to have your hands in the ready position so you could strike a guy. You know, I was always taught, yeah, you strike a guy, but once you latch on, then you use your feet. You become like a dancer. You use your feet and just mirror the guy. And I just don't think these guys practice their technique as much as they need to practice it. So it's just, it's second nature to those guys, and you don't have to think about it. Your body just reacts to what it needs to do. So that's the first thing I started noticing that, I would say probably about 10 years ago. And you had to back in our day. Why? Is because if you think about it, I almost faced the Hall of Famer every week. Every week that I played, when you talk about Lawrence Taylor, Richard Dent, the late, great Chris Dolman, Bruce Smith, Derek Thomas, you know, the list could go on and on about the guys that I basically had to face every week. You were facing a Hall of Fame type of guy. And if you weren't grounded in your technique, man, it was going to be a long game for you. I just don't know if those guys defensively are like that. We don't have those guys out there like that. You have some exceptions to the rules when you talk about a Chris Jones or, you know, I can't even really call too many other, you know, top quality defensive ends out that would, I would be scared of. Maybe your Michael Parsons, maybe those guys there. But we were littered with guys like that back in the day. So that's why I think that, you know, it's just a different era, just a different day and age. It's just a different player playing now.
Now, I know timing and chemistry are incredibly important to offensive line. Do you really have a chance to work on that with the way training camps are set up nowadays?
I don't think so. I think you have to put in a lot of that work on your own. You know, like you say, there's so many restrictions on those guys. With, like you say, you got that. I've never heard the acclimation period. You got 5 days to learn how to put pads on. I'm like, you know, or I think they have 11 or 12 padded practices for the whole year. I'm like, you know, or, you know, OTAs and mini camps, you know, what they can and can't do. It's just a lot of restrictions on these guys now. And the time that they spend with their coaches have been restricted down now. So what that does is it puts the onus on the guys to get the work in on their own. They have to. You have to be able to get this work in on your own. Or I just don't see how you're going to be successful. So, yeah, I think the NFL is looking at safety. And that's a great thing, because I wish they would have looked at it when I was in the league. I probably could have played a little longer than I played. But you are restricted to how much time you can spend with the coaches, you know, and how much time, I guess, you could be around the facility. So, yeah, I do think that's kind of hindering some of the guys' growth.
All right, final thing. What are your thoughts on the inter-squad scrimmages against other teams during training camp? Is that beneficial or detrimental?
I mean, yeah, it has its benefits. But how are you going to replace 60,000 fans screaming at you, the bright lights, you know, and you not, the plays not being scripted? Because the coaches, they sit down, the opposing coaches, they sit down and they script out what they want to see in those scrimmages when they go up against each other. You don't do that in a preseason game. You don't do that in a regular season game. So you don't know what's coming at you. Basically, you kind of know, the coaches will tell you, well, in this period, we're going to work on this, 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 and this. You know, so you kind of have an idea of what's coming. That's not the game. That's not game situation. You know, you don't have a clock, a play clock. Well, some of them do have the play clock, and they do have referees. But it's just totally different when you get in a real game situation compared to a practice situation or a practice setup as they're doing now against opposing teams. So I don't think it'll ever be anything that replaces being in the real game, being in that real setting, being especially a young guy, a rookie guy, a young guy coming in the league, you know, I think they need to see that. I think their eyes need to get big, and it needs to be something that they see before it really happens. And you just don't get that in a scripted practice or when you go against opposing teams in practice. And, I mean, again, a lot of these practices, they're not going to let you take the guys down to the ground. It's going to be an early whistle from the referees because they don't want to get guys hurt. And, guys, yeah, you're going full, but you're not going like you go at game tempo. So it's a big difference between getting ready for a regular game or participating in the preseason game compared to participating in the scrimmage versus other teams.
So one more time, where can people find out more about the Lomas Brown Jr. Foundation?
So, yes, if you go to LomasBrownJrFoundation.org, you can find out all you need to know about my foundation, some of the work that we have done. Like I say, some of the work that we're going to do. And, yeah, if you into kids and you want to help support kids, you know, that's the foundation to go to because that's what we concentrate on, trying to help our youth as much as we can.
Well, thanks for taking the time to speak with me, big fella. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ken. Take care. Have a great day.
Thanks. Thank you for listening to our interview with Lomas Brown. To learn more about the Football Learning Academy, go to our website at www.football-learning-academy.com. Not only will you find links to our social media channels and a listing of all podcast episodes, but you'll find other fascinating interviews and classes. And an important note, a portion of all proceeds generated at the Football Learning Academy go to help retired players in need. That website again is www.football-learning-academy.com. Thank you for listening.
You did not see their faces on the Wheaties boxes, nor did they have the headlines, but they were breaking barriers, one pitch at a time. The integration of minor league baseball, a history and player register, 1946 to 1959, by Rick Swain and Gary C. Fink, shines a light on the overlooked heroes who paved the way for future legends. From dusty bus rides to hostile crowds, these players fought for a place in a game that did not want to see them win. More than history, it's a tribute to courage, perseverance, and the power of a game to change. Honor their legacy today and grab a copy of The Integration of Minor League Baseball at your favorite bookseller.